Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for September 22nd, 2025. Tom, what do you want to start out with?
All right, so kicking it off this week, I have a short one to start the day. So it's an article from LastPass. It's titled Large-Scale Attack Targeting Max via GitHub Pages. So LastPass documented a search engine amplified campaign where attackers created fraudulent GitHub pages that impersonated legitimate vendor sites. These pages directed macOS users to paste terminal commands, which then fetched and executed a staged installer script. The installer ultimately deployed a known Mac malware. So this is the one that's more recent, the Avis Stealer. So some of the details under the hood here, they hosted impersonating pages on GitHub and then used search engine optimization manipulation or SEO manipulation to get those pages ranked high in the search results. This is things we've seen, but of note, and the victims, you know, basically lured to click the results and then follow the instructions on the pages. So it was like a redirect and a paste spin style command. So the GitHub page redirected to a landing domain that instructed users to paste that terminal command. And then that command used curl with base64 encoded URLs, which would lead the victim to the site, the fetch site, to execute and pull down the installer script. So the final payload, the installer fetched from the decoded URL, dropped an executable into the /temp, which LastPass identified as that Amos Stealer. So the installer executed from /temp and performed stealer behavior. So we're looking at, you know, the common things like credential and artifact harvesting, real consistent with that, with the Amos or atomic malware families that have been seen kind of throughout newer this year and since 2023. The campaign used multiple GitHub user accounts and repo names to host mirrored pages, and they used this methodology to kind of avoid takedown. Some of the impersonation scene were prominent companies too, like a lot of really big name ones that could aid in that trick, like you know, some examples: Fidelity, Citibank, LastPass, 1Password, Dropbox, and a ton more. So, you know, nothing overwhelmingly crazy with this, but it is interesting to talk about as far as I'm concerned from the macOS side, because it seems like we're seeing an uptick in this. I don't know if you're getting that vibe or not, Scott. But yeah, before I pass it over to you and get your thoughts, man, a couple things that I kind of pointed out, and maybe you could chime in or add to this. So when we're talking about hunting or looking for stuff like this, I think the thing that stands out the most is looking for that activity around those curl or maybe even wget commands that kind of have that entangled base64 string with it, or even maybe looking for things like command line that kind of look for that the curl or sh or a curl piked into a bash or sh that has those base64, you know, in the decoding. So yeah, you know, this one's a quick one, nothing overwhelmingly novel by any means, but I did think it was worth mentioning just specifically from the side that we're seeing, you know, more macOS kind of popping in the headlines a little bit. So, you know, I'll get your take on this, Scott.
Yeah, first I was interested that I didn't know LastPass had, you know, their threat intelligence mitigation escalation team. I mean, it makes sense because they're a big enough company and things, but I think it's really cool they're looking for these things external because, you know, kind of protecting their brand. But that's a great way to attack credentials, which LastPass is kind of around protecting in general. So I thought that was really cool and good work by them as far as like running this down and looking into it and then sharing it. So that was cool because I learned something new just about the company and their team related to that. The other thing, like you mentioned, I think the key things to always pay attention to is when you see curl activity and then the X attribute command and then chmod. I mean, obviously that means something's being pulled down and changed to execute. It might be legitimate, right? But I think that's how malware usually finds its way into places as well from a scripted perspective. So I think paying attention to those types of commands and executions and like what are they about The other thing, like you mentioned Mac, like we see a lot of Mac info stealers kind of servicing all over the place. So my thoughts, right? And this is just my opinion. You know, I'd expect that Mac's probably getting a little more popular, but it's still pricey. So a lot of organizations, I don't think, massively use Macs everywhere, but I also associate Macs with power users. So maybe there's a lot more benefit that if you do come across a Mac user, they may have access to more things. So it's like a bigger win, possibly. And then the other thing I'm not 100% sure on, so I'm making some assumptions here, but a lot of the credential protection natively to the Mac, like the key store keychain, it's really just protected by the user's creds. So if you're able to get the user's creds, you can kind of unlock everything on the system and any apps associated with that much easier. And an example of something I didn't know that I thought was interesting, if you ever use profiles, like a Chrome profile on browsers, you know, sometimes you can share profiles with other people. So you kind of have like a shared browsing experience or space, and maybe developers and things do that. But when you share a profile, and in those profiles, there's also keychains for passwords and websites and things like that, right? Well, now your local password is the key to unlock that keychain of that profile on your system too. So it's like maybe a stronger way to get at more credentials from a power user type perspective is kind of my assumption here. That being said, yeah, there's a lot of info stealers associated with Mac. It's we're kind of getting to that time where we have to pay a little more attention to what telemetry we get from Macs and what normal looks like, because I'll be honest, there's probably a lot of people, including myself, that don't really stare at that telemetry all the time. Now, I'm familiar with Linux, so I can understand some of the things that are going on, but I'm not, you know, as comfortable with like the native workspaces and how, you know, the Mac OS tries to secure things or limit things or containerize things and all that stuff that you kind of get a feel for when you just kind of, you know, start digging into data routinely. So yeah, there's my thoughts.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the power user side, because when you think about Mac, you know, you really start thinking about developers of different phrase, right? Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man.
All right.
Well, you got next for us.
Yeah, so this next one is a Talos article. I like Talos write-ups because they usually have, you know, deep dives into the right technical details. But it's called How Rainy Day Turian and a New PlugX Variant Have Used DLL Search Order Hijacking. Basically, yeah, Talos reports that there's a sophisticated malware campaign. It's been active since about 2022. And it's been targeting telecom manufacturing sectors in Central and South Asia. They discovered a customized variant of the PlugX, which is a remote access Trojan, but it shares traits with other two malware families, which is Rainy Day and Turian. So one of the things they used, one of the key techniques, and this is something the key to kind of pick up on, because they persisted for years, right? And sometimes if you just have remote access, right, or a back door, if it's not being leveraged, it can go unnoticed for quite some time. But to get those things installed is kind of where you get that's your moment to take the advantage there. And in this case, they're using DLL search order hijacking, which is just the vulnerability associated with DLL sideloading, right? And I've talked about it before, but I'll quickly cover it. So the vulnerability with search order hijacking is you can have a valid binary or executable, and it needs to load a library of code. So usually those can be stored in DLLs. And in the binary, instead of specifying the specific or doing some sort of check of the DLL that it's going to load or wants to load, it does it by name. And so the operating system, when things are done by name, the search order to find that name starts with, is it explicitly called, meaning it will go to the exact path that the binary says it should be. If it's not explicitly called, the next thing the operating system does is look for that name in the same directory that the executables run from, which in, you know, most DLL sideloading attacks, that's just what you do. You drop it the same place. And then the last thing it will do is, if it doesn't find that DLL in any of these two places, it looks in like the system 32, like the OS directory for that DLL. Maybe it's, you know, thinks it's calling a system DLL, which in some cases can be safer, right? Because if you're going to name something or do something by name, it's harder to overwrite those DLLs in the system because it could break things, for one. But two, you know, so that's, I think, why that function kind of exists the way it does. But that's how it gets loaded. Now, before I walk a little further, the one thing I did notice in some of the examples they were showing was we once again saw the single letter executable, which was just s.exe. So still laziness. That one was associated with rainy day. And then everything else kind of had its own name with the new plug X variants and the Turian malware. But they all used the same vulnerable executable. So I thought that was also really interesting. They didn't call that out as much as they did the fact that they used a lot of the same encryption keys. So then now they're, you have shared code, shared encryption keys, which is even, you know, where they use XOR and RC4. So that's kind of interesting. It means that, obviously, coming from, you know, groups that either talk to each other, but I have my theory on that too. But the fact they're also using the same vulnerable executable, it just makes me feel like, yes, it's a co-located group. It obviously focuses on espionage, other things to gain persistence. So they specialize in persistence. They're co-located because they're obviously sharing some techniques, but they're targeting different areas because one of them, you know, it was South Asia. There was I forgot which specific one targeted the Middle East more predominantly. So they had areas of focus, which I know, and they say it's driven from I say medium confidence. It's associated with Nikon, which is a Chinese speaking threat actor that's been known roughly around 2010. And then there's another group, Backdoor Diplomacy, they mentioned, which is linked in associated with Turian. They have a couple groups there. They, I guess, specify as unique groups, but they obviously have shared a lot together, and they might be, you know, China focused. And a lot of times when there's things happening from China, if you look at some of the historical attacks, they're all kind of tied to nation state, if not 100% nation state driven. But just for persistence and exfil of data, that's very much, if you say espionage, from even a business perspective, China specializes a lot in intellectual property theft to help drive their economy. So, you know, I can also go down that road as well. So yeah, it was really interesting to see a lot of the overlaps between these things. Now they talk about, you know, some of the things that the malwares will do. They'll either inject themselves into the primary executable that was vulnerable for the DLL sideloading. And in one instance, they actually tried to load into, Explorer, if I remember that correctly. Yeah, you know, Explorer EXE or WABMIG EXE. I don't know if that's a native Windows process or not. So yeah, kind of a good way of looking at, hey, you have these types of tools that kind of do the same thing, are different enough to be called different tools, but they leverage a lot of the same levers, essentially. And so you can kind of pull some ties into behaviors potentially and purpose. And, you know, I guess it helps a lot more with attribution when you kind of uncover these things. But once again, the three things that I would pay attention to: the laziness with a single character naming, you know, it can happen. The fact that I'm assuming, since they use DLLs, they take advantage of DLL search order hijacking for their sideloading, that DLL and executable will be dropped at the same time or roughly the same time. So you can look for those types of writes in conjunction as a strong indicator. But past that, it really gets into what can kind of look into certain tools or behaviors at like the machine level, which you're kind of relying on telemetry maybe produced by your EDRs and stuff. But what were your thoughts?
I thought it was pretty cool that they kind of like did a bit of a comparison. I won't repeat a lot of what you had already said. I just, echo that there's agreement points there, but I did also see, they talked about the rainy day one where they used, a lot of the old version of rainy days code. One of the things that was kind of hidden in one of the snapshots there, it looks like it was setting for persistence in the current version run key. Also, really, I'll toss you a question. So when we deal with the DLL side loading a lot, it's kind of off the thing that we're talking about, hunting for, things like that. And considering that it's leveraged by the naming conventions and stuff, what are ways you think, Scott, that people could, even before hunting, that could, really protect themselves or put themselves, cast a net around their environment to kind of shore up that from happening? Like, I always think about what would be a good way to solve that problem, to kind of mitigate it for my environment. Any thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, visibility is a big one because a lot of people don't track file writes. Either the tools don't do it natively or it's not something they're actually looking at, because I mean, let's be honest, file writes are being done, God, every minute, potentially on a system. But paying attention to DLLs and executables specifically, I would say, are really important. And like I said, the timing of it is all really, because if you get something from someone, drops something, someone downloads something, someone tries to email you something, you unzip and then extract those and run them. You commonly will see that executable and DLL writes simultaneously. Now, the challenge there, too, to pay attention to is if you install something, right? If you install something, it's going to unpack, it's going to put DLLs, but hopefully you can whitelist things like the program directories. Because even if you install something, it's going to drop those there. And so there's some exclusions that, are pretty normal to consider. But you also could, if you have file writes and you just kind of want to understand what that looks like in general, executables you can kind of find anywhere, but finding executables in weird places, it's a good thing to just kind of keep an eye on. It shouldn't happen that much, but I would say what would be even rarer is DLLs being placed in weird areas, or like user driven areas in some aspects, or public areas on, specific public directories. Because I think that's the only telemetry that really is the most consistent out of DLL sideloading that I've seen. And I've seen some interesting DLL sideloading attacks where there was one, and I probably need to go back now that I've learned more about it, where there was like double DLL sideloading. It was like a DLL sideloading that was supposed to then run something and then pull in another DLL to try to like skirt some sort of detection that way. And it was like, man, like that's different enough. I think seeing the executable in the first DLL would probably catch it, but the fact that they went through that extra step, and this was like, I don't know, a couple of years ago when I saw this, it's just something that it's weird. But once again, if I see multiple DLLs even written to like, the downloads directory, because you can't natively run, like you can't double click a DLL and execute it. The only way, if you really want to, execute a DLL independently, if it even has the functions to do so, you have to use run DLL 32 and typically call the DLL and then also name the function or the entry point that you're going to run to kind of kick it off to begin with. Because DLLs can be executables like, right? But you have to execute them in a certain way. So there's that too. But yeah, I don't know if that really helped, but that's just the best way I've seen thus far.
Something that I, just put in a little more sugar on top of it. Something that I noticed in recent months when looking at specific DLL hijack techniques or targets, there are a lot of places that have, where the DLLs are stored that allow public rights, but they typically don't update often. So let me think of a really loose example. So let's say like Microsoft's Office suite, right?
Yeah.
The DLLs in those locations don't update often. So if you were to consider, okay, I want to kind of cover myself down, maybe from a detection standpoint, maybe from a policy standpoint, you wouldn't see writes to those directories beyond updates. And usually when there's updates, it rewrites the whole packages. And there's other areas inside, you know, the various Windows directories or application directories that kind of work the same way. So that's another thought.
Yeah, you know, you got me thinking. I mean, that's a good thought as well. And I talked about, like, you know, could you inventory and just get an idea of what's out there? I think a really good file write alert, if you're just really focused on DLLs that might be weird, is look for, like, if you group DLLs potentially by name and look for rare instances where you don't see that DLL being written to a lot of hosts or whatever. And it could be pretty low because just like your example, if there was an update, right, an update to say Office, and they have a lot of public directories Office uses, like the whole program suite does. But there's this Office DLL, and it's in this weird public directory. You have no idea what it is, but it's across 1,000 machines in your environment. It's probably not an infection, right? It's probably not as something associated malicious. But like, you see this one thing in an Office directory, and there's only one machine that has this named DLL. It kind of brings it into question, right? And then if you can even figure out, depending on your file write telemetry, what wrote that DLL, like what process is responsible, that tells you a lot right there.
Yeah, that's a great point. Or worse, you see it connect, you know, you see it on maybe 5 out of 10,000 machines and they're all somehow written and they have a relationship tied. And it's like, oh.
Yeah, then you have to be like, okay, are these like the people that use those machines? Are they in the same department, the same function, that kind of stuff? Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Point.
So jump into our next article today. So this one's from Sentinel Labs. It's titled Prompts as Code and Embedded Keys, the Hunt for LLM-Enabled Malware. So this article is an abridged version of a presentation that was done at LabsCon 2025. That presentation was titled LLM-Enabled Malware in the Wild. And there's supposed to be a video replay that's going to find its way to hit the wild. So definitely something, if you're interested in this, to keep an eye out for. But this article was interesting to me, Scott, because it does come on the back end of us, you know, recently doing a live podcast talking about, you know, AI in the space and various angles. But we do continuously bring up the conversation about AI, and there tends to become this bit of a stale feeling, I think, amongst people like in our corners sometimes, where we're like, okay, you know, there's a lot of talk about AI and we're almost kind of like, you almost get this eye roll feel for it. But this article made me think a bit more away from that eye roll feel. You know, I'll kind of walk through it and we can talk about it more. But so LLM enabled malware, it really kind of introduces like unique challenges, like as malicious logic can be dynamically generated at runtime rather than embedded in code directly. So Sentinel Labs and his research identified these threats by hunting for embedded API keys and distinctive prompt structures, leading to the discovery of previously unknown samples, including what may be the earliest example of LLM-enabled malware dubbed Malterminal. So their methodology also revealed additional offensive applications of LLM, such as people search agents, red team benchmarking utilities, and tools designed to inject code vulnerabilities with LLM assistance. So some of the traditional approaches that they kind of talked about, and I put traditional in air quotes because this is very much a new territory for us all, but you know, things we typically see when we talk about LLM or AIs in the malware space have usually been like designed around the idea of it. So one of those instances are like the LLMs as a lure. So, you know, like social engineering, convincing someone to download this new AI program that they need or that's going to help them do a thing. Then we've seen things that were, you know, attacks on LLM integrated systems as another example. We're starting to kind of see, and I put this one in air quotes because I think there's still a lot of room for interpretation to this, but malware created by LLM. So this is very, like a very immature kind of space, but it tends to act more as the first draft than then it's usually taken and manually modified by attackers. Think of it similar to the way that we would use a tool like ChatGPT to help us with our day-to-day work. But now we're looking at this LLM-enabled malware, which is, you know, pretty much the primary focus of this article. There are very few examples of successful malware that leverages LLM, but there are a couple recent ones that show the evolution happening in real time, at least to a degree anyway. So you have two things that I'm going to kind of reference here that were referenced in the article, PromptLock and LameHug. And LameHug's been, that's very recent. There are two big examples of this evolution. So PromptLock was actually a proof of concept developed by NYU to show the dangers of AI-powered malware. Whereas LameHug is often attributed to APT28 and had, it actually incorporated 280 plus unique Hugging Face API keys. So they had it at their disposal to kind of leverage prompts and scripted malware to enhance the attack and discovery process. So Sentinel-1 also identified something not previously known, dubbed Malterminal, in the LLM malware space. Though dated as likely developed back in 2023, so this one is like they feel like it's one of the first iterations of the. But some of the points that I found interesting in this, Scott, as a whole, and kind of like pointing more towards a discussion piece, is how to, you know, to really think about hunting for AI powered malware that leverages LLMs. And they've really, in this article, put out two areas I thought were very thought provoking. So when they talk about prompt hunting, so since every LLM-enabled app needs to issue prompts, researchers search binaries and scripts for common prompt structures and message formats. The hard-coded prompts proved to be strong indicators of LLM and often revealed the software's purpose. So instead of hunting for code, the LLM-enabled malware can be hunted by its prompts. So I thought this was very interesting. So this approach works best when combined with like a lightweight LLM classifier to score prompts as malicious or benign. So they look at the code, they identify what they think is prompts, they run it through an LLM classifier to say, does this look more suspicious, is how I took that, which allows kind of a quick flag on things that should be prioritized or samples that should be marked suspicious. So I thought that was really cool. The other side too, and this one I think is more hyper actionable for right now for anyone kind of out there. So the API key searches. So the researchers wrote Sentinel-1 researchers wrote Yara rules to detect API keys from major LLM providers like OpenAI, Anthropic, which use unique patterns. So as an example, Anthropic, their keys start with SK-ANT-API03 currently. And then OpenAI keys include a very specific Base64 substring. So these are predictable structures that made kind of like a retro hunting possible. And they did a year-long scan of virus total and uncovered over 7,000 samples with 6,000 unique keys. The majority of them were non-malicious, often from a developer mistake or an accidental leak. We've talked about how that happens scarily too commonly. But some malware samples also contain keys but didn't qualify as true LLM-enabled malware. But about half the files were actually really focused and heavily targeted Android apps. And let me get back here. So this is what I really thought, Scott, and I'll take a second to stop rambling here, but I thought the whole prompt hunting and API key searches, especially when you look at like specific tools have very unique and common predictable structures around their API keys that you could pretty easily hunt for if you were to see something like this occur in your environment, I think. But I enjoyed this article because what I thought it did is it put more of a spin on, hey, there are things actually occurring and ways that we can actually go at it now. So there's like actionable stuff here, as well as showing the evolution of how this is trying to be developed on the attacker side of the house, right? But I thought it was a great write-up and I love the topic. I know we're talking more about AI, but this pointed out a few things we haven't discussed yet. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, Scott.
Yeah, so I think this is always interesting because this makes me think about how in security, you know, we have to evolve with the attacks, but one of the most important things we have to evolve with is once we understand attacks is what telemetry is really relevant. And it takes me back to early days in security where, you know, you would be getting all this threat intel that would give you hashes. And you're like, okay. And you learn what hashes are, right? And you're like, wow, this hash is so powerful. It's an exact fingerprint. I will know if I can search for this hash in my environment, if this malicious file in this report is in my environment anywhere is ever run. And then you go look in your data and you're like, there are no hashes anywhere that I could leverage. So then it's your job to then find a file that you might think will be it, hash it yourself and compare. And you're like, God, why is this so hard? And then along came Sysmon, and it was like, oh, why not just everything that runs quickly hash it? So we have a record of that. And then that enables all that threat intelligence that helps you leverage those types of things. And then, you know, as security and adversaries mature, you realize that hashes can be very powerful, but it's so easy to change a hash of a file by just changing a few bits in it. And it will dramatically change it. There's no really way to get around that. Now they came out with fuzzy hashes, which kind of help you associate with, oh, this is how things get loaded, I believe, the fuzzy hash works. Or it hashes multiple things that kind of get like a chain of things. They can kind of fingerprint common executables, I believe. Which could kind of help, right? But I mean, I don't know many tools that actually provide that. I feel like Sysmon actually does, but I think they do. But you know, not a lot of tools provide that, because I mean, that's still a hard thing to address. And so now we're coming to this LLM thing, where they're like, hey, they uncovered there's some really good, data with malware and research of like, I guess experimental proof of concept stuff of what this could look like. And they're like, man, there's API keys, because obviously that's how you'd have to communicate with the LLM from a systems perspective. And they're hard coded in there. Oh, and then, you know, not providing code, but you're providing prompts. And, you know, the challenge there is now you have to have a tool that is actually looking into the binaries to look for these things when it scans. So it's not something a human can do. You're hoping that vendors get smart enough to deal with this problem and then can then provide you the right telemetry alerts from that, which isn't my favorite thing to do because it's kind of that black box. And the other thing, when you think about the prompts, I don't know if you've really tested it, but you can really, really butcher what you want to say in a prompt, and LLMs are pretty good about understanding what it is you're asking for. So like the level of obfuscation that can occur from prompts itself would be really kind of a challenging signature to go off of. Now, granted, it would still be good to look for like key words or terms or something like that. Or, you know, if your endpoint EDR tool is so sophisticated that it could pull something it thought was a prompt, throw it to an LLM and have it decipher it. Yeah, maybe, right? That might be the future of some security things. But like you had said with the API key perspective, I feel like, you know, headers, HTTPS headers, because typically headers aren't encrypted. I think in the new HTTP standard or HTTPS standard, they actually are for privacy's sake. But the actual header usually will have the API key included, right? So you have access if you collect any kind of web data, or, you know, if you have even not necessarily like full PCAP, but any kind of network data where you kind of carve that out. Maybe even Zeek. I can't even remember now. It's been so long. I believe it collects that kind of stuff as well. But you can have API keys. And the API keys can kind of have signatures to themselves because there's the format of the key, the length, there's prefixes, like you've mentioned. But you also can get like the host or authority, which kind of gives the domain and where it's actually going. And then the content length itself in the header might tell you something about, is it a short little text thing or is it like a full file, you know, and what does it look like? What's the content length? Is it chunked? And then even the user agent sometimes can reveal, hey, this isn't a normal call. It's not like from a browser. It's from something else like Python or curl, right? It could be interesting on top of all of that. So there's a lot I think you can get from that data. Now, what would be really interesting is if EDRs, because they can sit in between where the encryption typically occurs, even if it is HTTPS, if they were actually looking at headers for certain web traffic from executables and they could alert, hey, we see an API key, we see this, this, and then it captures some other additional data, maybe from even the body. So you can see that might be of use right in the future if they start collecting and using that. That granted, who knows, that might be a lot of data if we start using LLMs involved in everything. It's definitely, I would say, a telemetry that now is more important than it used to be. I don't know how often people used headers for a lot of their hunts and or detections for things. I know I haven't, but like I said, as security challenges change or evolve, what usually changes with it is the telemetry. And so that's why it's always important to say, like, this isn't what you collect for security and that's it. You should always be revisiting, like, what is the most important based on threats, based on what we're, where we sit, what we have access to, from a data perspective. And so I would say it's time to start looking at headers, at least initially, based on some of the research that's coming out with, you know, the artifacts that may be beneficial. Now, what I say might actually hold no water once someone starts looking and realizes, oh, there's so much noise here. This is going to be much harder than just saying, hey, we kind of group things together here. But that's where my head went. So kind of reminded me of that whole like paradigm with, you know, we struggle with, oh, we need something and it was hashes and we got hashes and that was only good for so long until we're like, oh, now we need something else and we need something else. It kind of goes down that that road. But I do think looking at the headers now, one caveat, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I was trying to do some research real quick about, can the API key be in the body versus in the header? And it can be. It depends on how the API is defined or designed. But from what I can tell, a lot of the like OpenAI, Anthropic, Hugging Face, all those things, they typically will have it in the header. And in the rare instances where it might appear in the body, might be associated more with like posts or puts. But it depends, like I said, how that API is explicitly defined. In those cases that might be there, or, you know, it historically, I guess, has been there. But yeah, I don't know. That's kind of what I came up with when I was kind of looking at this and thinking about it.
That was a good point. Yeah, it's a, you know, API keys flying around in the wild, man. It's that thing. I think about it too, like really kind of like what you referenced, going back to like when we used to consider certain things like hashes and stuff like that, and we used to put a lot of weight in certain things like that. You know, kind of fast forwarding and looking at like how much we've evolved. And, there was a time, I think way back in the day when we were younger and starting out in this field a little more, where no one was leveraging APIs. Like it wasn't very common. Now it's just everything has
automation, you think?
Yeah. And a lot of people, I think, because, you know, the simplicity that it tends to be there to leverage APIs, there's this kind of quick connect, get to the results type of thing. And we throw these API, our API keys out at all kinds of different stuff in different ways. And then those systems eventually become critical or primary or things like that. And you completely forgot about some of the established points of throwing these API keys around. And we're seeing it because we're talking about it, you know, pretty regularly about, you know, exploited or captured API keys. You know, when you talk about like Lanebug, for example, they're sitting on hundreds of them that they've managed to get from somewhere. So it's, be mindful of your API keys for sure.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point. Like API usage is definitely increased. Now, I would also expect, because there's more use of it, potentially API style attacks also might increase to some point or resurface to some degree. And I only say that because more and more things will use them. And if more and more things are using them, more and more developers are trying to integrate things and speed becomes then a thing, and to market becomes a thing. And so there could be things that are possibly missed. And in a lot of instances where I see API keys being abused is when the API has more capability than was intended, and then it gets kind of utilized that way. So, if you're somebody that knows that you guys leverage a lot of APIs, or you provide a service to people as like that's your product and it has APIs, something it might be worth looking at, because if more people are looking at APIs in general, they're going to find risks or vulnerabilities associated with them.
I wonder too how often people are considering rolling those keys, because if you're holding on the keys that are still apparently leverageable from 2023, you know what I mean? Like considering it, thinking about it that way, it's like, meh.
No, I mean, that's an interesting point, because like, if you think about like the oldness days where they're like, roll your password, it has to be greater than 8 characters and roll your passwords every 3 months or something. And they're like, oh, that's not necessarily as important. We need longer passwords. And API keys are kind of like service accounts, where the recommendation is have a really long password for a service account, because it's a service account. And you can roll it like once a year. And that was considered best practice. But APIs are so publicly kind of exposed in a way, depending on, or can be exposed, depending on how things are being passed and handled, right? Versus like a service key or service cred isn't publicly exposed per se. It's usually internal or local. So I wonder if there's, like you said, a better practice as far how often you roll those that's different from like a service level account that we're not really thinking about.
And maybe it's a different approach, instead of thinking like, hey, I want to make sure somebody can't guess this or figure this out. Maybe it's like, I want to assume somebody had gotten it after a certain point, so I want to roll to the new one so they can't continue to utilize it. That's a crazy thought, but maybe that's the angle we need to come from there.
I mean, we talked about attacking developers potentially with the Mac stuff and getting advantage. Like, you know, if you get inside to a system, there's a lot of like stealing of creds. You know, what's to prevent someone from putting a listener on a production machine looking for API keys?
Yeah, we've seen it completely in the whole NPM fiasco that's going around with that Shai-Hulud thing. That's exactly what was done.
Right. Exactly. So yeah. So like, it's just like, that's that could be another, like another area of risk that people need to consider. So yeah. Moving on to risk, the last thing I was going to bring up here was a Trend Micro article, and it's called AI-Powered App Exposes User Data and Creates Risk of Supply Chain Attacks. So this is just like a good lesson learned type article. Basically, Trend Micro discovered that an AI-driven app called Wondershare Repair It, which is used for repairing images and videos, exposed to sensitive user data and internal developer materials because of a weak security in its cloud backend. And basically, it's not uncommon, and we talked about like API keys, or you know, cloud access keys, which basically are API keys, are being stored in binaries for applications so they can access cloud resources for specific things. And almost always, I feel like when there is a cloud breach or issue, it's because of basically too many privileges being allowed on specific tokens or keys that are needed. There's not like it's usually the lack of least privilege. So those hard-coded cloud credentials in that binary, in a typical developer fashion, based on the way the software sounds, should have been set up where it could write to the cloud store, but not necessarily read and do everything else per se. Maybe not the same way, or maybe it, you know, needed some other mechanism and as far as the design, but it was able to write and read and modify all the base privileges you would expect on like a storage, right? And that was kind of part of the problem. Like I said, it's not uncommon to have keys included in apps associated. The other part of the problem was that in the cloud storage itself wasn't just like, say, my data that was going there, but it was all the data. Like anyone that is using this is all going to the same cloud store. and also is co-located with all the developer stuff. So all the binaries and developer code and everything, all accessible as well. So, you know, what are the problems associated with this? Well, there's supply chain attack problems, because if an attacker wanted to leverage, they could replace some of the developer code, weaponize some of the developer code. So as people, if this app, you know, grew in popularity or is really popular, I've never heard of it, so I assume it's not hugely popular, but it'd be a great vector for a supply chain where now all of a sudden people are installing and doing things in a normal fashion, not realizing they have like a backdoored app. And so, you know, that was a kind of a huge strategic architecture no-no. And then the other thing is all the data being stored, even in that cloud instance, is encrypted. Was not encrypted, which kind of, depending on where you are, GDPR or even, you know, other types of regulatory stuff, there's privacy laws associated with that. So that's kind of a problem as well. And, you know, when you think about, let's say you needed to, based on how the app works, you need to have the right cloud token or API key to have those privileges, but you would generate your own unique encryption key for the files you load up or pull down. That in itself would kind of solve a lot of the problems, because even if you can access a bunch of encrypted blobs, if you wanted to dump a bunch of things, you didn't really necessarily have access, right? You can touch binary bits, but you couldn't really discern what they were. Unless, you know, I guess you can try to brute force or do whatever kind of attacks you do with encryption, right? But that also wasn't being done. So yeah, like the big like recommendation they kind of mention is, you know, fine-grained access tokens. I mean, as painful as it may be to discern, hey, what needs what, it's worth going through those practices, especially for more critical areas of your business, just because it'll save you a lot of pain in the long run, but it also gives you a really good understanding of how things work when you go through that process as well. The only thing that I think when people go through that process for the least privilege and really like fine-tooth comb is make sure to document it all in a very intelligible way so that someone can easily understand the privileges and design as well. I feel like that doesn't come hand in hand. And so then when it comes to something doesn't work or we need to fix something, that's when all the privileges get dumped back on, because they're like, I don't know, but I'm going to give it everything for now to get things working again. And then we'll figure it out later. And it doesn't quite get figured out the same way. The other thing that they obviously mentioned was monitoring and auditing the access tokens. So yeah, I mean, that would be good. I don't know. That'd be a trickier thing if you just have a bunch of random access from whoever downloads your apps kind of thing. But, you know, maybe there's something that could be done there. And then building security into your CI/CD pipeline. Basically, you know, that's your developer pipeline, scanning for embedded secrets, make sure you know what those secrets pertain to. But sometimes, you know, stuff like that does kind of, as you're in development, you put something somewhere for ease of use to make sure something works, and then you kind of secure it later. That's kind of hard to clean up. So having ways to look for that is always something to consider. So yeah, more like a good lessons learned, because I don't think a lot of people think about secure design or like, I don't know, some of the best practices, things to even look for. Like if you were to tell me, hey, go audit this app, I would be like, oh, okay. Like, oh, what is the app access? You know, what is it? You know, and I wouldn't like maybe have like that hit list of items. I think this article spelled out a lot of important things to consider that would help me build that list of, all right, these are the things I need to consider. Like, follow the data. I remember in like troubleshooting technical things, it was like signal flow. Where does the signal go next? Where does the signal go next? Where does the signal go next? And then where does it break? I feel like when it comes to like auditing things like this, it's like the data flow. Where does the data go next? What happens to the data? Where did the data go next? What happens to the data? And if you can tell that story, at least get a good understanding on how things are being done the way they should be done. So yeah, I don't know what you thought.
Quite a few things when I was kind of going through this one. It feels like we're in a catch-22 situation when it comes to AI and these tools and all of these developers building these new tools. You know, because a lot of the thing you want to do is as fast as it's all moving, especially from a typical user or even a power user standpoint, people are trying to stay up to speed with what's out there or what can be used. They're trying to leverage these things to do more. There's a lot of success in some of the tools that have been built already. They're flying off the shelf fast. And at the speed of that, from my experience, I feel very strongly that DevSecOps is just an absolute afterthought to a lot of these programs, a lot of these apps. It's also in this space, me particularly, and I'm just speaking for myself, and anyone can take this how they will. I'm overwhelmingly reluctant to put any AI-powered anything app on my machine, like a localized app, for that specific reason. It's one thing to leverage a cloud platform and to kind of go through that process, but once I start dropping these things on my machines, I feel like I'm just knowingly opening myself up to an exponential amount of risk, because I cannot, with any reliability, feel strong about that DevSecOps part of their development process. And this is just an absolute example of that. Not to mention the fact that, you know, as these things are kind of going, like it's scary that this isn't necessarily being thought about as well as it should. Because it's, you know, as much as we fear supply chain types of attacks, you know, when somebody gets a hold of your binaries, manipulates them, and then you're passing them everywhere, every which way and whatever. And then we start, you know, the AI stuff is starting to become more interconnected. We're talking about the leveraging of APIs, all of the stuff that's interconnected with each other. It's like, I be reluctant when it comes to these tools. Like, don't be, you know, the grouchy person out in the corner just saying that's for the new kids or something like that. Like, be, you know, be interested in it, be curious about it, use them, but just really, yeah, I don't know, just think about it a little bit. Like, don't just jump to the next thing because they're, you know, it's scary, and it is a catch-22, because we have to stay aware, but there's just so many things happening so fast. I'm super reluctant, Scott. I stay away from anything that's going to be dropped on my machine that says anything about AI powered, 100% again, for those reasons. And, you know, I'm always curious, because the DevSecOps stuff, for the things that we're seeing, I wouldn't think, and maybe it's just a bias because we're in this field, but I wouldn't think these things are necessarily overwhelming or super cost heavy to consider implement in your development processes, right? In most cases, but I don't know. I'm not doing it myself, so I could be speaking out of turn there. But yeah, be cautious, because this is the warning examples of how fast is it going and what could come of it.
Well, I did not think it was interesting that there was a mention that said that they were kind of wondering if the design of this app itself potentially used AI to help write it. So there weren't the same checks and balances because it was kind of being reviewed by AI, and it was kind of like, yes, sure.
GPT said it's safe, right?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, yeah. And it, safe means so many different things to different people. Like, context is super important when you try to describe safe. Like, will this safely run on the system? Yes. Will it safely protect everyone's data? No, probably not. You know, like, so, but
well, that's happening. We know that that AI is writing apps, applications for people. We know it's writing code for people, and we know it's being distributed. You can look is simply to social media. You can go down to, you know, applications that go on your mobile devices and beyond. Like, we know that's happening.
Yeah, the thing that I think you made me think about it, like, I would never put some sort of AI agent or AI thing, which, I mean, exists, right? They all kind of exist in some form or fashion. I mean, like, Copilot exists on Windows. It's kind of annoying.
You've got to give it a little more scrutiny, right? So if you're talking about something that's being developed from a company that has decades of experience kind of working through some of the processes, considering the security, you know, absolutely never perfect.
It's their brand, yeah.
it's a known entity. Like even walking more newer, like ChatGPT is kind of a known entity at this point, right? But there's thousands of these AI applications out there now, right?
Yeah. So, you know, when you talk about like social engineering and or like learning about targets or data collection information or even doxing or things like that, like imagine if someone downloaded a malicious AI agent and all it did was read every single file name and structure on your entire system. It could probably profile what are your interests, what are some of the things you write or talk about, just on like file names alone, what are the things you use a computer for, like all that stuff. And it'd be super efficient and it would just be completely AI powered because all it is just doing your basic metadata collection of a system and dropping it into them and saying, what can you tell me about this person? Like that to me is kind of terrifying. Because the level of invasion of that is just, at levels that like, if you gave me that data dump, it would take me too long to even get the right value out of that. But something can do that within like minutes of getting that data dump. Yeah. So that's,
yeah,
I think stuff like that is, can be very impactful. And I mean, and I could see where, man, you know, at a nation level, what they can learn about its people by doing something like that. That would be, very invasive.
I feel very strongly and confident in saying that that's already happening somewhere. It's happening because the technology's here, right? So it's of course being used. You have to imagine that that's happening, even if we haven't heard colorful stories about it yet.
Yeah, I'm hoping that you know, maybe somewhere, some place is saying we could do this, but we won't. But yeah, that's not.
I mean, we see it, right? Like in general, we've seen it for years now with the way that, you know, search engines or, you know, the applications you drop on your cell phone profile you and serve you up ads, right? Like this methodology is already being leveraged. It's just, you know, how heavy can it be leveraged and even more through AI tooling and by threat actors specifically, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The telemetry that, you know, I could, you know, dig through. It is crazy. So, you know, leave it on a positive note. But yeah, no, I thought this was like really good conversation. You know, the things we dug into, I really love to hear people's feedback and comments and hopefully promoting if they like what they hear as well. But I really want to thank everyone for joining this episode of Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. And I look forward to syncing up back next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of September 22nd, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.